A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hello and welcome to Unheard. I'm Freddie Sayers. The war in Ukraine is going on, even though it's not on every front page every day anymore. And something interesting is happening, which is that as regards what the end state might look like, what victory or defeat might look like, what governments and the media are saying in public is quite different from what they say in private. The Zelensky government has taken a very hard line, talking about nothing short of recapturing Crimea, as well as the areas of eastern Ukraine, would be tolerable or even possible for them when thinking about potential peace scenarios. But when you speak to people in private, they're a little bit more realistic. This division is actually really, really important and something we want to understand. Happily, someone called Anatol Levin has been following this closely. He's a former war correspondent, and he's now director of the Eurasia program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft in Washington. He recently got back from a long stint in Ukraine where he was interviewing ordinary people, soldiers, government officials about their views and what was really going on in the ground. He joins us from York in England. Hi, Anatol.
Hello.
This question of Crimea, it feels like it's almost becoming a sort of taboo because, as I said in the introduction, what people say in public is very different to what informed people are saying in private. Is that what you observe as well?
In part, yes. I mean, there were also highly informed people who said in private that Ukraine must recover Crimea. But there certainly was a very perceptible difference among people in general between what people were prepared to say on the record and off the record. Because, I mean, very understandably, as a result of the Russian invasion, but also, you know, very much as a result of government rhetoric and government control of the media, a public mood has been created whereby nothing but complete victory will do. And I think that this also reflected the fact that in the autumn, after a string of extremely impressive Ukrainian victories, the reconquest of eastern Kharkiv, the reconquest of Kherson, the Ukrainians really had the idea or got the idea that they could completely defeat the Russians. But now, as we see from the latest Pentagon leaks, an awareness is growing, and also, of course, you know, Ukrainians have talked to Western officials. Western military analysis now is that for the Ukrainians to go further and to reconquer all the territory lost since 2014 will be extremely difficult for them. If the Russians stand on the defensive, as they now clearly intend to do, dig in and use their artillery superiority, the Ukrainians will have a very hard time. There is also the belief that Russia would, in the last resort, escalate very seriously if Crimea did seem to come under threat. So really, whichever way it goes for the Ukrainians, even if, as they hope, they manage to recover all or most of what they've lost since last year, at that point, they will come under serious pressure, I think, from the West to seek a ceasefire.
You say escalate seriously. I think most people would listen to that and wonder whether you mean nuclear. Do you?
Not straight to nuclear, no. I mean, and probably not in Ukraine, if only because the Russians would be using nuclear weapons in territory that they claim is theirs, which would, even by Russian standards, look a bit paradoxical. But, you know, there are many other ways in which they could begin a process of escalation. For example, they could knock out American satellites, which have done so much to help the Ukrainians with intelligence. A former CIA friend expressed surprise to me that the Russians haven't done that already, given how much damage those satellites have done. Or, of course, they could sabotage Western infrastructure. And they would say that this was simply in retaliation for the alleged American destruction of Nord Stream. But you can see how this would begin a spiral of escalation and American and NATO response that could, in the end, finish up with nuclear war.
So there's kind of two things going on here, aren't there? One is that this idea of reconquering all of the territory and including Crimea is not likely to happen. It's not actually very feasible, whilst publicly the impression is given that it is. And then secondarily, even if it could happen, it wouldn't necessarily be desirable. One phrase I've heard used is catastrophic success, and how powers in the West want to avoid catastrophic success from the Ukrainians. So could we just go through those first? What is your evidence for the idea that actually reconquering all of the Donbass plus Crimea isn't going to happen?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's completely impossible. The Ukrainians, you know, have surprised us again and again. And, you know, armies do sometimes collapse as the Russian army collapsed in 1917, for example. But it certainly looks fairly, you know, unlikely in military terms, because the same things that worked for the Ukrainians when the Russians were on the offensive will now work for the Russians when they're on the defensive.
Such as?
Anti-tank weapons, superiority in artillery, and simply the fact that in highly built-up areas, these work to the advantage of the defense. I mean, look at how the Russians have been held up in Bakhmut for 5 months now. So it doesn't look terribly likely.
You also mentioned mines in your report from Ukraine. So tell us about that. There's now thousands of mines on both sides of this increasingly sort of stable front.
Every Ukrainian soldier I talked to, and that included several who had lost legs to mines, talked about mines as a really major factor. Both sides are using them. But of course, mines are a defensive weapon. And I was told that, you know, a lot of the time Russian attacks fail chiefly because of mines. They send forward small groups to try to, after heavy bombardment, to take Ukrainian positions. They blow themselves up on mines and then they stop and go back. So, yes. And I mean, mines obviously have an effect in bogging down and freezing the battlefield.
Is it not illegal? I mean, I know it sounds like a detail these days when you're engaging in such a major war, but was there not a big treaty to stop putting down landmines? And why is Ukraine, as well as Russia, ignoring it?
Well, the United States didn't sign it either, because it uses mines in South Korea against a possible North Korean invasion. So, I mean, some countries have signed the anti-mine convention, others have not, but it's really a case of the pot calling the kettle black here.
So we think practically it's unlikely. It's a edge case scenario in which Ukraine is able to suddenly take over all of that territory. To move on to the second question then, would it even be desirable if it was possible? What's your view on that?
Well, one thing that is very striking is that if you talk to people, intelligent people, both in the West and in Ukraine, and ask them, you know, why it's worth taking the immense risks of trying to reconquer Crimea, not just the immense risks, but also the possibility that Ukraine will, you know, have to go on and on and on attacking, using up its manpower, using up its reserves of weapons. And when you push people, the first answer is, well, we must inflict a total defeat on the Russians so that they can't threaten Ukraine again in future. And then you say, but losing Crimea won't do that, because after all, Russia will still be there with a 1,000-mile border with Ukraine. And indeed, losing Crimea might create a mood of revenge in Russia, which would make a future Russian offensive against Ukraine even more likely. Well, then the answer is very often, yes, but losing Crimea would bring down the government of the regime of Putin, which I think is, if it could happen, it very likely would. And then you say, well, but, you know, Putin is only one Russian ruler. You know, there will be more Russian rulers who, you know, will carry on the war. Then the reply very often is, ah, but the fall of Putin would bring about the disintegration of Russia. It would basically end Russia as a united state and finish it off as a great power. So, I mean, the intention or the hope in reconquering Crimea goes far, far beyond Crimea itself, as far as thinking people are concerned. But of course, the reply to that is precisely that to ward off that possibility, Russia really might escalate towards the use of nuclear weapons.
So really, it's a case of careful what you wish for. And it appears, at least from the conversations I've had with people who are behind the scenes and wielding influence in the West, is that yes, although there is this public statement that, you know, nothing short of the 2014 boundaries would be considered acceptable, they're not going to tolerate this kind of aggression being rewarded with territorial gains, etc. In private, what they say is this is a public posture because they don't want to cede ground to Putin, you know, in this kind of negotiation before it's necessary, whilst in reality they accept that there will have to be a territorial deal of some kind. Is that what you hear and see as well?
Well, it depends on who. After all, you know, you have East European governments, notably the Poles and the Balts, who are now part of the West. They wield enormous influence in NATO and increasingly in the European Union. And they are determined to, yes, indeed, I mean, carry on this war to the end. And if possible, destroy Russia as a state for, you know, historical, emotional reasons. In Washington, I think you're quite right about a majority of the Biden administration, not necessarily all, if you look at the record of Victoria Nuland, for example. But if you look at the commentariat in the West, or certain Western figures like Annalena Baerbock, the foreign minister of Germany, then you know, there are also some very hardline figures in the West too, and I think part of the problem is, which is true both of the Zelensky government but also of the Biden administration, that as you say, I mean, the Biden administration has been really thinking of this as a bargaining counter, but the public language that they've used about the return of all Ukrainian territory will make it considerably more difficult for them to indeed, you know, make a compromise in future, even if this is a compromise that they themselves would desire. I mean, both Washington and Kiev have, to a considerable extent, and Brussels too, painted themselves into a corner here.
This is what I really want to dig into, because those Western powers we just mentioned might think they're being very kind of wise and sophisticated here by maintaining this public posture, privately acknowledging that it will have to move. And they think that's sort of good four-dimensional chess or game theory or whatever else. But meanwhile, there are audiences within Ukraine that are hearing it much more literally and are believing it very deeply that now nothing short of reconquering Crimea will do. And there are audiences outside Ukraine in the international community, such as Poland, such as some other states who are very anxious, who might also be taking it quite literally. So let's talk through those. You've been in Ukraine, you've spoken to a lot of people, you've looked at opinion polling evidence. And one effect you report in the latest foreign affairs piece is that there is now a pretty strong majority within Ukraine to basically stop at nothing. Peace is not attractive if it involves surrendering or as they see it, Crimea, or acknowledging that Crimea is now Russian. Tell us about that evidence and why it worries you.
Well, certainly, I mean, all the people I talked to on the record said that. And a majority off the record as well, though there was a definite regional difference there between people in Kiev and north of Kiev and then people in Dnipro and Zaporizhia in Russian-speaking areas of Ukraine. But the thing is that, the head of Ukraine's National Security Council has said this openly, as a result of encouraging this belief, which may be a fantasy, and nailing his government to it, Zelensky has put himself in a position where if he then does go for at least, you know, a ceasefire, which would freeze certain territorial issues, he is going to face massive protest at home, led, of course, by radical nationalists, but also, I fear, by the military, which is, judged by the soldiers I talked to, absolutely committed to complete victory, and, of course, by a range of politicians hoping to replace Zelensky as president. And as the head of the National Security Council claimed, and he's one of the hardliners, if Zelensky were to accept a peace deal with Russia, he would have committed political suicide.
It's actually quite a terrifying scenario.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
You paint, because it means that Zelensky may not be in charge of what actually happens. I mean, he's very popular among Western countries. He's become a bit of a hero. But if the reality within his country is that now there are hardline nationalist groups that possibly have control of the military, have been heavily armed in part by us, and now there are, as you talk, you know, growing proportions of the general public who would support them, Zelensky's position is not secure. So although he might be planning to kind of bring this standoff to the perfect moment of maximum power and then offer a deal to Russia, his people and his army might not accept such a deal. So there might be we might be forced into a much more dangerous situation, even if Zelensky doesn't want it.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I doubt that as long as the war goes on, you would have a coup against Zelensky, because that would be suicidal for Ukraine. But you could certainly see enough pressure put on him to block a deal. The other thing, which, of course, I'm sure Zelensky is thinking about, that two historically aware Ukrainians said to me that, yes, you know, in the West, Zelensky is portrayed as Churchill. And, you know, indeed, Churchill was a great wartime leader. But three months after the war, the British public threw him out of government by a huge majority. And they were clearly hinting at the fact that they not only expected, but hoped that that would happen to Zelensky as well.
So, in fact, it's hardline groups within Ukraine, you know, need to be dealt with sooner rather than later. Because if there's going to be any hope of a negotiated peace at any point, no matter what that looks like, there's going to be trouble from those people within Ukraine who don't think it's good enough. They basically, I mean, I can tell you, I was in a private gathering with a very senior Ukrainian diplomat who, and he may have been joking, I said, what scenario would you be happy to negotiate peace? And he said, I'd be happy to negotiate peace in the smoking ruins of Moscow. Now, it was a private gathering. He was joking, but it gives you a hint of the kind of talk that is going on inside Ukraine.
Well, some advisors to Zelensky have said that more or less on the record, at least that, you know, that they will only accept complete Russian defeat and nothing else. But I mean, how to deal with these people? Well, of course, in the middle of a war, when national unity is prioritized, and also the United States regards Ukrainian national unity as essential and a great American asset, that isn't going to be easy, particularly because, of course, some of the most extreme nationalists, you know, the famous Azov regiment, some of whose people I talk to, has gained tremendous prestige as a result of its genuinely heroic role in the war. I mean, I think the answer is that if Zelensky is to be helped to make any kind of ceasefire, because I think it would only be a ceasefire, it would be, it wouldn't be a formal peace settlement. That would require, the strongest possible stance by the United States and much of Europe. He would, in fact, have to be able to claim to his own people and his own hardliners that he was absolutely forced into a ceasefire, and that, otherwise Ukraine was going to face the abandonment of the complete cutoff of Western aid. Well, of course, to do that would require tremendous political courage on the part of the Biden administration and tremendous unity on the part of the European Union and NATO. And without wishing to sound too cynical, those are not qualities that one has very much identified.
It becomes harder and harder the more public pronouncements there are saying the opposite. You know, it's not going to be convincing that they're forcing him into a peace that he can say that he doesn't like if they're on the record 1,000 times saying nothing short of full surrender will do.
I mean, a Chinese diplomat years ago said to me that, you know, you in the West spend years and years by talking and talking and talking. You talk yourselves into a corner. And then you have to spend more years getting yourselves out of the corners that you talked yourselves into. If you're not sure what to do, much better not to talk about it.
I mean, it's sort of the height of irresponsibility, is it not, Anatol? This kind of tendency towards black and white, Manichaean, goodies versus baddies rhetoric that is now popular, not just about things like the Ukraine war, but on all sorts of issues. And it seems kind of partly driven by social media and sort of desire to be on the side of the angels all the time. The fact that you've got leaders now engaging in it, potentially, well, they think they're being really virtuous by backing Ukraine to the hilt, saying all the right things in support of Zelensky. Actually, they're making the situation much more dangerous for both Zelensky and the ordinary Ukrainians.
Well, I think that's right. And of course, this black and white thinking has long been characteristic of the United States. If you remember, you know, the Bush administration after 9/11, you're with us or you're against us. But you know, more recently, this has really spread to parts of Europe as well. I mentioned Annalena Baerbock, you know, the foreign minister of Germany, who sees things in an extremely black and white way that I think that the previous generations of Germans who had actually gone through the Second World War would not have done. They would have had, you know, a bit more moral, you know, modesty and self-awareness there. And I mean, I do have to say that the much of the, it's not just the social media, but much of the Western mainstream media has, I mean, in part, you know, understandably as a result of, you know, very justified outrage at the Russian invasion and the destruction that it's caused. But, you know, there have been a really serious failures of analysis, of objective and deep analysis, and indeed, you know, objective and accurate reporting. I mean, I was talking to one American correspondent who shall remain nameless, and when asked why he didn't, you know, and he spent he's mainly stationed in Ukraine, spent months on end there. When asked why he hadn't reported about internal political splits in Ukraine, he said, "Oh, he finds that too unpleasant." And when asked about the Ukrainian state's suppression of independent media and of, you know, free discussion in the media, he sort of hummed and hard, and he said, "Well, yes, maybe that is an issue, but you know, my role is basically to report the war." Well, you know, that was not the kind of journalism I was trained in by the BBC, admittedly now 35 years ago. You know, it does. There is a tendency towards simply producing propaganda.
I guess their argument, you know, probably people will watch this video and say, why are you doing the Russians' work for them? I mean, because that's the argument you hear all the time. You know, why focus on fractures within the Ukrainian government? Why focus on hard nationalist components that might be dangerous? Why be realistic or even, you know, sanguine about the chances of Russia making gains? All of those things, because you're doing Russia's propaganda for them. That's the accusation. So what is your counter to that? What's the moral case for being realistic about the situation in Ukraine?
In the words of Dr. Zhivago, to a challenging a Soviet propagandist after the revolution, because it is so. And it is the duty of a journalist, of a responsible Western journalist, and this is what, after all, we have been preaching to the rest of the world, and, you know, endless journalism courses for people from the former communist bloc, from Asia, from Africa, in which, you know, Western journalists claim superiority and the right to teach for money, because we are supposedly so much better, so much more objective, so much cleaner and more accurate. It is the duty of a journalist to report the truth. You can comment on it as you wish, but the facts have to be reported. And one of the reasons is that, in the end, I mean, academics like to sneer at journalists, but when writing about contemporary affairs, of course, academics get all their information from journalists. Well, actually, of course, policymakers as well, and certainly parliamentarians, people in the US Senate get most of their information about everywhere in the world from American newspapers. Well, they don't even read newspapers anymore. They watch television. If the information that they are getting is fundamentally inaccurate, then you cannot have a fact-based Western policy. So in other words, it's not just the journalists who do this are betraying their calling as journalists. They are actually undermining the role of the essential role of the media in politics, society, and policy making.
So, final thought from you: we've talked about journalists. What about the leaders? What would you like to see from everyone from Rishi Sunak to Joe Biden to leaders in Europe, von der Leyen, you know, potentially even Zelensky himself? Are we talking about a sobering up of the language used, a dialing down of rhetoric, and beginning to make space for some kind of compromise? Or what would you tell them to do if you were their advisor today?
Well, I tell them to go on supporting Ukraine, certainly, to defend itself, and also to do, you know, more in humanitarian terms. We could be doing a great deal more. One of the reasons we aren't is that we've created this image that just to travel to Ukraine is hideously dangerous. The British Foreign Office, you know, will not help British citizens to go to Ukraine because it has a travel ban. In fact, in the places that I visited, and I wasn't allowed to go to the front line, I was facing no serious danger from the war whatsoever. The level of Russian bombardment of the cities is far less than has been alleged, and far less reported, and far less accurate. So we should be doing that. But on the other hand, I mean, what I have repeatedly reminded people of is that already, actually by last summer, certainly by the end of last year, in historical terms, and also in terms of what the Russian government had hoped and expected at the start of the war, Ukraine has already won a huge victory. Now, 20 or 15 years ago in Ukraine, if you had traveled in some of the Russian-speaking areas that I traveled in, because I did travel there before in as a journalist in the 90s and then as an analyst, you would have found huge amounts of sympathy for Russia, desire for close relations with Russia. That has vanished as a result of the war. You know, the Russian speakers of Ukraine really are now united with others in hostility to Russia, even if they, you know, have somewhat different ideas about what victory should mean. And where we are now is that, you know, Russia has, since last year, managed to occupy actually quite a small area of southeastern Ukraine while losing permanent 85% of Ukraine. Now, that is a transformation, not just, you know, compared, as I say, to Russian hopes at the start of last year, but compared to the past 300 years of Ukrainian and Russian history.
What is it you want to see Western leaders say that they're not saying?
They should say that we've already won a great victory in Ukraine and for Ukraine, and that means that we could now afford to compromise.
I think that's really interesting. So, in other words, your suggestion is to flip the rhetoric from being nothing short of the 2014 borders, including Crimea, would constitute a victory, to we've already won. I haven't heard that being suggested before, but it's an interesting idea.
Well, that's because not enough historians are writing about this. But for somebody who actually knows, as I say, the history of Russia and Ukraine, not just past 300 years, but almost past 400 years, it should be bloody obvious. I mean, you know, the vast majority of Ukraine will now be fully independent and pro-Western. Now, that crushes Putin's hopes, but as I say, it also reverses, you know, everything that's happened to Ukraine since the mid-17th century. And I would also say that, you know, those people who believe that our task is to back Ukraine to the point that, you know, Russia is so totally defeated that the Russian state collapses and disappears, should have the honesty to say that clearly in public, so that Western publics and electorates and members of parliament can make up their own minds. And if they, you know, if a genuine majority in the West decides, yes, that is and should be our goal, okay. But then we would at least know what we were aiming at and what we're risking in the process.
Something tells me that the phrase regime change is not going to be very popular with a lot of voters in the West. But we shall see. Anatol Levin, thank you so much for your time today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
It's a really important point, that idea that talk of total victory, of reconquering Crimea, which is so common among Western politicians and Western media, could actually be the most dangerous thing of all. They obviously think it's the moral high ground, that they're being virtuous, but is it creating momentum that will be hard to stop? Could it lead to even more frightening escalation? Thanks to Anatol Levin for sharing his thoughts and to you for tuning in. This was Unheard.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.